2 weeks of violence have plunged Sudan into turmoil. Hundreds of people have been killed and tens of thousands have fled. The country is home to more than 500 ethnic groups and is rich in natural resources. Are these factors linked to the conflict? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tom McRae. Sudan's people are once again living in fear, suffering the consequences of all-out conflict between the army and paramilitary rapid support forces. The cause is multi-pronged. Sudan has a troubled history. Its diverse population is composed of different ethnicities and societal groups, and it is rich in natural resources. We'll be speaking to our panel of guests about how these factors could be influencing the current fighting and Sudan's future. But first, Alex Baird has this report.
2 weeks of waking up to the sound of airstrikes and gunfire. Sudanese are caught up in a battle that's been in the making for a long time. A political power struggle rooted in ethnic and regional divisions, further complicated by the fight for control over natural resources such as minerals and oil. At the centre of the conflict are two generals, the head of the army, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and the commander of the rapid support forces, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemedti.
Both men are known to the African Union fairly well. And this has been going on for quite some years. This is not a conflict that has just, you know, sort of broken out. So I am optimistic that the levers that the AU has together with IGAD is going to yield some result, but it's not going to be a straightforward thing.
Sudan has more than 500 ethnic groups, and politics has long been dominated by an elite based in and around Khartoum. Burhan has traditionally garnered support from his fellow Sudanese Arabs, while Hemedti has a significant base among non-Arab ethnic groups in western Sudan, including Darfur. This is partly because he's from a non-Arab tribe, the Mohammed. Both sides have tens of thousands of fighters, foreign backers, and vast resources at their disposal. The army controls most of the economy, but the paramilitary group oversees gold mining areas. The country is Africa's third largest producer of the precious metal. And in 2021, about 90 tons of gold on the global market came from Sudan. It also has deposits of copper, iron, chromium and uranium, as well as abundant arable land which supports the agriculture-dependent economy. Sudan is located on the Nile River, vital for irrigation and hydroelectric power generation, waters it shares with Egypt and Ethiopia. It borders another five countries, nearly all of which are mired in conflict. The country has strategic ports on the Red Sea, the only points of export for around 135,000 barrels of oil a day, most of it from South Sudan. Despite this, the United Nations classifies Sudan as a low-income country. If this violence continues, it could spill over and affect regional access to water, mineral exports, and oil supplies. And then there's the unfolding humanitarian crisis. The fighting has killed hundreds of people and injured thousands. There's a shortage of food and fuel, and hospitals are out of service. Many countries have evacuated their citizens, and tens of thousands of people have fled, all of which is putting a better future for Sudanese even further out of reach. Alex Baird for Inside Story.
Okay, joining me now are our guests in Montreal, Khalid Madani, Associate Professor of Political Science and Islamic Studies and Chairman of the African Studies Program at McGill University. In Cairo, Raja Makawi, Editor of Africa Arguments, a platform for news, investigation and opinion, and author of Sudan's Unfinished Democracy. And here in Doha, we have Waleed Madibo, the founder and president of the Sudan Policy Forum. Thank you very much for joining us. Raja, if I can begin with you. You've just arrived in Egypt after fleeing Sudan. Can you just give us a brief explanation of how difficult that journey was and how hard it was to escape Sudan?
It's very, very difficult. The reality is that Sudan, or people living in Khartoum, have been kind of under threat of conflict and bombardment for the last 15 days or so, are all scrambling to leave Sudan through the, through the route they know most and which they're familiar with, which is Egypt. So you've got thousands and thousands of people who are on the same route, taking the same route towards the same kind of crossing points. The situation at the border is very kind of difficult and protracted. The crossing point itself, Argin, is not a human kind of, a crossing point. It's a cargo one. So it's not set up to receive thousands and thousands of people every day. So you've got a situation where people have been kind of squatting for weeks now. I mean, it took me a week to get through with almost no access to any basic services that people need to maintain themselves. Food is very, I mean, there's no food and water. I mean, there are no bathrooms. The security situation itself is quite dire. And, the state itself, at least on the Sudan side, is not, I mean, access to information in order to give you updates on what you need to do in order to get out is not at the level that is required to help people move on in a straightforward and easy manner. Yes.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine the difficulties that you and the tens and tens of thousands of other Sudanese have had to go through just to get to safety. But we are extremely grateful that you and your family are safe at this point in time. Khaled, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about ethnic divisions in Sudan and how that might have played a role in the lead-up to this conflict. I mean, is this simply a war between two generals basically vying for power and influence themselves, or do you think that there are deeper ethnic divisions to this conflict?
Well, I would say that it is not so much ethnic, but a political crisis, of course, reflected in the competition, political and military competition between these two generals. But I think the notion that this is an ethnic conflict is something that's oftentimes, not correct. There is no correlation in Africa or Sudan, frankly, if you don't mind me saying, between the density and the number of ethnic groups and conflict. And so as easy as it is to say and reduce this conflict to inter-ethnic conflict, it's just not the case. I would suggest, and my guests, of course, can chime in, that historically the issue in Sudan is an imbalance between the center and the periphery. That actually gives us a much more better understanding, not only of the present conflict, but also the decades, really, and particularly the last 30 years under the rule of Omar al-Bashir, in which the primary investment of the country, of course, upwards of 60% of the national budget under Bashir went into the military. The remaining went into a very kind of limited geographical triangle around Khartoum, around the River Rin area. Specifically Dongola, Al-Ubaid, and Sinnat that Sudanese know full well. And that really had to do with the concentration of power at the state, at the level of the center of the state that dates back to the colonial era. Understanding it that way, that is the conflict, the historical one between center and periphery, can help you understand the conflict between, the National Army, of course, that is manned by many from the central part of the country, and Hemeti himself from the so-called periphery, but who does not necessarily represent, in fact, he does not represent the majority of Darfurians, as you can imagine. In addition to that, that kind of lens of looking at it from center and periphery vantage point also helps us understand the issue and conflict in eastern Sudan, as an example, a very marginalized culturally and politically and economically, historically, and what we call the two areas of southern Kordofan and the Blue Nile. Understanding it between as a history, a long history of imbalance between center and periphery, both in terms of absence of representation in terms of those in the margins, but also the absence of economic investment and infrastructural investment is really important. I want to conclude that my answer by saying, actually, we also have to understand demographic change. Khartoum itself, the greater Khartoum area, which, I think houses approximately maybe 7 to 8 million, I need to check that number, is actually extremely diverse. It's not the Khartoum of the 1950s and 60s. It's a Khartoum that encompasses all of the different ethnic groups. In other words, the battle between these two generals is not hitting one specific ethnic group and another. It is hitting all of the ethnic groups from in the entire country, all of whom have families and relatives in the greater Khartoum area. And I think that's really important to emphasize.
Yeah. Well, Waleed, what do you make of Khaled's points there?
I think it's very well said and well put. I just need to add some important points here. There are three levels to this conflict. There is the conflictual issue, a personality issue between Burhan and Hemeti. And there is, and at this level, we would have to remember that Hemeti was used by al-Bashir to against the army, and the Islamists used him as a paramilitary force that they could use anytime there is a coup d'etat in Khartoum. So there is this level, and there is the second level, which is the dynamics, the internal dynamics between the RSF and the Islamist groups, because we have to remember that the Islamists, they have gotten rid from starting 1989. They started getting rid of the professional officers, and they started ideologizing the army itself, and gradually they moved all the defense duties to the intelligence department. Mm-hmm. And when the civil war erupted in Darfur, they used the RSF, which was at that time Haras al-Hudud. So there is this dynamics at the second level. At the third level, we have to remember very well that the social basis from which General Hemeti has been recruiting his forces are areas of Darfur and inside Darfur, mainly the Arab tribes. It's only recently that he has started incorporating some indigenously African tribes. So the question is, ironically, these are the areas that are mostly rich in Sudan. I mean, if you think about what the professor has just said, I can just add to it that they, in order to grow agriculture in the Sahara Desert of northern Sudan, you need $4,000 per fadan, compared mm-hmm. to only $134 in Darfur or Kordofan. So we need to think about marginalization, about center periphery dynamics, but we can't ignore the fact that there is a historical tension between, from the time of the Mahdiya, between the people of Western Sudan and the people of the center here, people who have okay. who have dominated the politics for almost 70 years.
Yeah. The Doctors' Union has just put out a statement saying that at least 74 people have been killed in West Darfur, and that locals there are now beginning to arm themselves, believing that the conflict is inevitably going to reignite ethnic violence in the area. I mean, how alarming is that, Raja, do you think? And do you think that that is what is going to happen?
I mean, it's quite alarming. Darfur has had a long, long history of conflict whose patterns are kind of, shaped by the politics in the center. Again, to reiterate Dr. Khaled's points about kind of, the center periphery kind of, framework or lens of trying to understand how Sudan functions. But I think it's also very important to kind of look beyond the idea of ethnicity as just a racial marker. In Sudan, ethnicity is a political construct, one that's been concocted and driven by the state with the purpose of consolidating its power. A central state that's quite weak, whose reach is very limited, have sought to use certain kind of ethnic groups in certain parts of the country to try and kind of, you know, manage and consolidate power. When I think of ethnicity, that's what I think of, not, you know, people's social markers.
Khalid, I mean, is the worry now that both the army and the rapid support forces are basically going to recruit different groups, recruit different ethnic minorities, basically to fight one another on their behalf? Is that what you think could happen?
I think that that attempt, since the period of Omar al-Bashir, that injection of inter-ethnic hatred and even racism on the part of Bashir that he used not only to help to execute his proxy war in Darfur, but also to put down the revolution, the pro-democracy forces, the if you may recall, at the beginning of the uprisings in December 2018 and early 2019, he accused the protesters of being from Darfur. Interestingly enough, that was when the slogan "Kullina Darfur," we're all from Darfur, really emerged as a popular one. I think, frankly, in Khartoum itself, if not elsewhere, there is a clear recognition that this is a political crisis and a political competition between two generals representing their own interest and the interest of a small group of allies. In the case of General Burhan, of course, former members of the National Congress Party. In the case of Hemeti, a small group of militia. I know that the number is large, but these are paid, and this is what we mean by mercenaries. They're not actually recruited on the basis of ideology or ethnicity. They're recruited as a result of money being paid. And so I think that generally the Sudanese people absolutely understand that this is not one of inter-ethnic conflict. In fact, that has been tried in the past, and Sudanese are fully aware, and you can see that in Khartoum. I don't see that that is actually going to work. That doesn't mean the violence will diminish or it'll be a little bit easier. These are very strong forces. I want to also add to Dr. Raga's point in terms of how ethnicity plays out in Sudan. I visited Darfur many times, even during the war. And I want to really be very clear. The notion of Arabs versus Africans in Darfur, which is so popular and so easy as a marker, from our experience and actually, you know, personal and also in other ways, in terms of research as well, it is really linguistic markers in Darfur that count. And in addition to that, issues of economic livelihoods. There is no other way to understand the history of intermarriage. I can tell you a number of different anecdotes when I was there in terms of the relationships between the different ethnic groups that identify based on their linguistic markers, either originally Fur or Zarawa or Arabic language. So the issue of the pastoralist versus, you know, non-pastoralist, agriculturalist is really the primary way Darfurians define themselves. It's important because that's the only way we can understand issues of conflict resolution, which are going to be so important.
OK, I want to move on to Sudan's natural resources, of course, which it has in abundance. There's gold, productive farmland, oil, all these things we mentioned in the story at the beginning of the programme, and, of course, the resources that the Nile and the Red Sea coastline throw up as well. Waleed, obviously there's huge foreign interests in Sudan, and there have been for many, many years. How is that impacting this current conflict, do you think?
Before answering that question, I would want to highlight something very, very, very quickly. I mean, if we look at the conflict from an anthropological or sociological perspective, then what the professor has said is absolutely right. But if we look at it from the political perspective that the government, the Islamist group, has ethnicized politics and politicized ethnicity, then when we look at the IDPs, we find 2.5 million from a strictly indigenous African population, basically Masalit, Fur, Tunjur, Daju, Zagawa. So here is where the conflict takes some sort of an ethnic tilt. But to go back to your question, which is very important. Wagner now with General Hemeti, they are doing explorations in southern Darfur in the areas of Sangu and Radom. They have a very big plot of land from which they are exploring gold and embezzling it to UAE or Russia. And that represents almost 77% of Sudan's export of gold. So here, if we look at the issue of gold, it's a very sensitive issue. You do have uranium in Jibal al-Nuba, or I would say in Nil al-Azraq, some parts of Janub Kordofan. So that what makes the conflict a little bit dirty is the fact that the resources are in the areas that are mostly conflictual ethnicity-wise. I mean, the way that the Islamists have driven the conflict has made it very difficult to separate the issue of ethnicity from the issue of resources. If we think of Jabal Amir, from which Himeti has been exploring gold for years, that belongs to a certain tribe, I mean, quote unquote, Bani Hussein, that were driven away by some Rizegat groups. And then later, the Islamists, or basically Umar al-Bashir, they subdivided the Rizegat into Mahriya and Mahamid. So they have played a very devilish role in separating the ethnicities in Darfur, and more importantly, more grievously, linking it to the issue of resources.
Mm. Raja, obviously Egypt has a huge stake in what happens in Sudan, not least because there's tens of thousands of people like yourself and your family that are trying to flee Sudan and get into Egypt. What is its interest there at this point in time, and where, if any, does President Sisi's allegiance lie? To which side?
I mean, Sudan used to be part of Egypt until independence. And I think the ties are not just, you know, historically social, with communities kind of intertwined through marriage and, you know, right to move and work and whatnot, but also the political system. Sudan's political system builds to a large degree on kind of the historical institutions that it had inherited from its time being under, from the time it was a condominium and being under the protectorate of Egypt of sorts. Mm-hmm. This is kind of, you know, translated in the more recent period of kind of, you know, a problematic political relationship between, you know, the two military elites. Egypt, you know, the kind of, you know, system, political system, and governance system it has in place relies to a large degree on kind of, you know, securing its southern border, and also securing kind of an acquiescence of Sudan's military elites as well. So yeah, the two systems basically build on each other.
Yeah, Khaled, I mean, who's backing who here, and why do you think? Which countries are backing the army, and which are backing the rapid support forces at this point in time, and how much influence do they have over both of those sides?
Well, I think in the case of Egypt, it's very well known that in general, Egypt is backing Burhan as an individual, even if they are opposed to the remnants, or rather the Islamist former members of the National Congress Party, because obviously Egypt is opposed to their Islamist movements in Egypt and in the region. Nevertheless, this is a marriage of convenience. Egypt has always wanted a reliable, from their perspective, stable ally. The relationship between Burhan and Sisi is close. Egypt wants that not only for strategic reasons, but also for economic reasons as well. And of course, the concern for them at the moment are the Nile waters and their competition and conflict with Ethiopia. And that, of course, for Egypt is an existential kind of issue. So their relationship with Burhan, they're counting on, and I'm not sure that that's actually a good calculation, that somehow that they could have a complete influence over him without having to deal with Islamists of the National Congress Party, many of whom have been released from prison over the last 3 days, for example. So I think that Egypt is finding itself in a difficult situation in that respect. I think historically, as you know, the United Arab Emirates has assisted and supported Himeti for first in 2015 when they utilized him as well as Burhan to send mercenaries to the war in Yemen. And of course, they have interest and have had in terms of the gold trade. There's no question there. That's not a secret. I do think calculations have changed. The end of the war in Yemen, I think the participation of the UAE and Saudi Arabia in the Quad over the framework agreement signals a change in strategic kind of perspectives, having to do with the fact that instability is something that the UAE, of course, and their ally, Saudi Arabia, is concerned about for a variety of reasons, including their interest in the Red Sea area. And that's why they entered into negotiations. That's really important. The issue of Wagner and Russia oftentimes is over-sensationalized. I don't believe that Russia has as much influence. And I think that my guest can have perhaps different opinions. I do think that the relationship between gold and the Wagner Group and Hemeti is important. I don't think it's the most important. Hemeti has a wealth of other resources, and that's really important. All of that is to say that there are changes in the strategic calculations. At the moment, I feel with the expansion of this conflict and the way that it's threatening the kind of strategic interest of all of these actors that had found their clients in Sudan previously reliable has will lead them, from my perspective, and I'd like to hear what the guest here, my colleagues say, will have to lead them to actually try to do what they can to stabilize the situation, at least in terms of cessation of hostilities. And already we're seeing statements about the political settlements from these actors.
Yeah, we're rapidly running out of time. Raja, I want to finish with you. How does this conflict end, and how soon do you think or hope you'll be able to return to Sudan?
I'm hoping so. I mean, my family, like many other families, their lives are in Sudan, their houses. That's where the children go to school. And most of us are, even if we live as diasporas, we are connected to Sudan in many ways. We travel yearly once or twice, I mean, more than once. So yes, I don't see I'm hoping that the conflict would cease because there is no kind of tangible, long-term, conducive alternative. Otherwise, we're talking about, again, a migration crisis. How are people of my parents' generation supposed to kind of exit and leave the country when, you know, in their 70s? How are they supposed to kind of resettle? So all these questions definitely kind of raises concerns about the need for hostilities to end and for people to be able to make safe passage back to their homes and their lives.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. But thank you very much, all three of you, for joining us. Khalid Madani, Raja Makawi and Walid Madibo. Thank you very much for joining us on Inside Story. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Tom McRae, and the whole team here, bye for now.